Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Late Night Sessions. I'm Eli Janney from the HE Band, and sitting in with me today is Mr. John Worster. Hello, John.
Hello. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. John's an amazing musician, comedy performer, writer. You've had many interesting jobs, and I'm so happy you're here to talk about them today.
It's great to be here.
We first met through Superchunk, right?
Yes.
You're drumming for Superchunk, but I want to start right off by going back before Superchunk. And in researching this a little bit, I realized that, like, oh, you had this whole history before Superchunk that not many people know about.
Well, if we're going to start at the beginning, we'll start with Hair Club for Men, which was in 1981.
Wow.
I was going into ninth grade, and we played a lot of new wave covers.
That's so great.
Yeah.
The one that really piqued my interest was Right Profile.
Yes.
How old were you when you joined that one?
I was 19, and The story of how I got into this band, they were based in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was really into that Southern pop world when I was in high school. So like REM, Let's right. Active, the DBs and things. And I would send away for records that I saw were either produced by Mitch Easter or had connections to those
kind of people.
Yeah. So I saw a review of this band, The Right Profile, in the back of Trouser Press magazine.
Wow.
Which was like a...
Taking it back.
Yes.
An actual magazine.
New wave kind of punk rock magazine that was really great and big back then. And so I sent away for this record by The Right Profile. It was like a little EP, 7-inch, and struck up a correspondence with one of the co-songwriters, who is this guy named Stephen Dubner. And my brother, by coincidence, gets a track scholarship to Wake Forest, which is in Winston-Salem. And one day he calls up, so this is like late 85, and he says, I met these guys, The Right Profile. I know you have their record, and they're looking for a drummer.
Wow.
And by chance, that week, the band I played in after Hair Club for Men was called Psychotic Norman. And we used to rehearse at our bass player's house. And he was a little bit unreliable in several ways. But this one particular day, he didn't show up for rehearsal at his own house. and I was kind of annoyed by that. And I remember going home that night and calling my brother and said, I want to try out for this band. And my parents amazingly called up Piedmont Airlines, bought me a ticket, and I flew down, I auditioned, and I got in the band.
Wait, your parents bought you a plane ticket to go audition for a band?
Yes, because at the time I was working in a toothpaste packaging plant.
Nice. So they figure, you know.
This has to be better.
He can probably go, first of all, he can probably go back to that, no problem.
Yes, yep. And I should add that it was the graveyard shift. I went in at midnight.
Wow. So you went and tried out. You joined this band, Right Profile. You went and played at CB's.
CBGB's, yep.
What year was that?
My first show with the band was, I think, in January of 86. I got in the band the week of the Challenger explosion. I remember that.
Wow.
Yes. And I think my first show was maybe a month or so later. And then we went up to CBGB's. They had tables there, and there was a little card that said, reserved for Mr. Clive Davis.
Was he there to see?
He was there to see us. And this is a kind of a layered story. So he comes and sees us and he says he loves it. He loves it. And there were a couple other record company guys there too. And at this point we had managers, and it was the two guys that managed the Replacements. And they factor heavily in Bob Mayer's great Trouble Boys book.
Okay.
Russ and Gary. So Clive Davis signs us. I think a few months later, I think we were signed by the summer, and I'm 19.
That's bonkers.
So it's crazy. And then it went directly into like the equivalent of, in the film business, turnaround, where you write a script and they're excited for like a week and then they want to change it or tweak it and it just kind of ends up on the shelf forever.
Yeah,
so
falls apart.
That was kind of our thing, what happened. And then I found out a couple years later that we were kind of a revenge signing. Basically, there was a guy that worked at Arista who wanted to sign us, and for some reason, Clive wasn't that into it. And then that guy left to go to another label and wanted to sign us there.
Oh, so he grabbed
and
them.
That's what I was told, and it kind of makes sense. So then Steve Dubner quits the band. So he leaves the band after we did some demos at Sam Phillips' recording studio in Memphis.
Also amazing.
And the guy that engineered it was this man who, at the time, I thought he was like 80 years old. And his name was Roland Janes, and he was the guitar player on all those seminal early Jerry Lee Lewis records. And he just ended up getting a gig engineering. And so it was with Jim Dickinson producing, who did Please to Meet Me by the Replacements and Big Star Third. And it was great. It was a great time. But it was kind of becoming clear that Jim Dickinson liked the other guy's songs better. Jeff Foster's the other guy.
Okay.
So each guy wrote their own share of songs and sang them. Almost like The Clash, where there was two very distinct voices. And so I think Steven just got discouraged by that. And he ended up leaving the band in the summer of 87.
And went to pursue a writing career.
Yes. And we still lived in the same house after he quit for several months. And he had, it felt like he had like five jobs. And like he'd get up in the morning and he'd deliver papers. Like he would go to the local paper and he had like a paper route. And he was a man. Like he was in his 20s.
He's an adult man.
He was an adult man. And he was also a writer for The Weekly. So he was like an entertainment writer. And then he ends up moving to New York and he gets a job for the New York Times Magazine. And it just goes on and on. He writes some books. And then eventually he teams up with this guy named Steven. Another Steve.
Another Steven.
And they write the hit book, Freakonomics. And I think there's a Freakonomics too.
I love it. I love that you played drums in the band with that guy. Levitt. Steven
Levitt.
Now, the other thing that caught my eye here was that after the Right Profile, you were in a band called The Carnies. But was that the same group of people?
So The Carnies was basically The Right Profile without Steve Dummer.
Oh, okay.
Without Steve Dummer.
Oh, so it's the same band,
kind
essentially.
Of, yeah. But it became more of like a roots rock band. And unfortunately for us, the Black Crowes filled a need that we were more than willing to fill. So we never really got rolling, but we recorded a five-song demo at the Hit Factory here in New York.
Yeah, that's what I was like, wow, that's pretty good.
So that was
the long-gone Hit Factory.
Yes. Wow. So that was wonderful. And that was the week the wall came down in Berlin.
Ah.
And it was produced by Steve Jordan, who was the drummer in the David Letterman band and co-producer of Keith Richards on his solo stuff. And that was like a life-changing experience for me because he was so great. And it really made me a way better drummer. And I think that's sort of the most important musical education I've ever had. And it was just like 5 days. We would go to his apartment and kind of rehearse a little bit. And he never really showed me what to play, which was really nice. Or was just...
He didn't sit down behind
the kit. No. So not intimidating at all. And we recorded at the Hit Factory, which is where like... I think The River was done there. And just tons of...
Wasn't John
records.
Lennon, didn't he record there too?
And so Steve produced it, and that was just an amazing experience. That was great. Nothing really ever became of those songs or that session, but it was life-changing.
The demos didn't get bought.
Yeah.
And that was 1989.
That was 1989, and Nico Bolas was the engineer who engineered Freedom, the Freedom album. And so he...
I have to stop saying wow, but
no,
that's
no,
pretty...
No, it was exciting. And he... found out we were from North Carolina, so, you know, we're hillbillies. And so he sent out to, I guess it was the stable where the horses for the police department are kept.
Mm-hmm.
And like had 10 bales of hay brought up to put in the studio because that's our natural environment.
You got to be kidding
me.
No,
we haven't. No.
Was he being a jokester?
I think it was, but yeah. And it was back in the day where your budget was just whatever you wanted.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was constant just like sending
out
that's
for true.
Stuff.
Yeah, 1989, especially that place. 2 years later, you moved to Chapel Hill.
Yes.
And what precipitated that? You already had this musical career.
But there was nothing going on with the Carnies. Like there was just this Death March tour out to LA to get signed.
Right.
And our guitar player for that tour was this guy named Andy York, who has been John Mellencamp's guitar player forever. So he made out well after
wow.
that. So I moved to Chapel Hill and became a window washer. I did. And,
that's so great.
And one of our clients was School Kids Records, which was the cool record store in Chapel Hill. And Mac McCann from Superchunk is working there.
Who works there?
Yeah. Who's judging people's purchases as they come? That sucks. So this is such an odd sort of way the universe works kind of story. The day I got back from this Death March tour out to L.A. to get signed, which came to nothing, I had to stop eating on the way back because I didn't have any money. The lowest you can get. By this point, I'm living in Chapel Hill, but I'm playing in the Carnies still. So I stopped to see my brother on the way to the house that I was sharing with him and his girlfriend. And I stop at his office and he goes, "Hey, Mac from Superchunk was asking about you." I said, "Oh my God, I wonder what's happening. What's going on? I could feel maybe something was happening." So in my window washing job, I go to School Kids to clean their windows, and he's working, and he says, "You know, we're having some difficulties with our drummer. We're going on this tour with Mudhoney, and we just want to see, you know, if this is salvageable or not." And so I started learning songs, you know, while I'm doing my window washing, got the Walkman on and Superchunk songs, just in case.
It was a cassette Walkman.
Yeah, and it turned out that whatever was happening was not happening. He called and said, do you want to try out or just play? And so I went to his house, and I think it was just the two of us maybe. Maybe it was the whole band. And we played some songs, and they talked, and we went up to a restaurant, and we had food, and they said, "Well, I think you're in if you want to be in."
Nice.
And that was the beginning of it. So that was around like maybe September of 91. So all you window washers, make sure you...
Make sure you get to the record.
Get to the right
cool
record
stores.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Because
the other thing that I wanted to talk about was more about your writing and your comedy career. So you're playing drums in Superchunk and making records and touring incessantly. But there is a break. Like, how did you start writing and performing comedy stuff?
The comedy stuff, that started when I met Tom Sharpling. Tom Sharpling is a Jersey guy, and he came to a Superchunk show. This was like the ultimate indie rock power bill. This is 1992. At the, it was called The Ritz in New York City.
The old Studio 54?
Yes.
That's what it, yeah.
Yeah, and so Pavement on first, Superchunk second.
That's
and My Bloody Valentine headlining. And Tom Sharpling already knew Superchunk, and he had a fanzine back then called 18 Wheeler, and he did a story on Superchunk. So he came to the show, and he and I just hit it off that night, mainly over Chris Elliott, the comedian and great writer guy. And we just became friends, and we talked on the phone for years. Like, every day we talk on the phone. And then Tom got a radio show on WFMU, and we had this idea. So now we're around, like, 1997, where I'm going to call in as this guy who's written this dumb rock and roll.
I love this story.
The idea is I'm calling in as the author of this really misguided rock and roll guidebook called Rock, Rot, R-O-T, and Rule. I've written this book, and I basically lay out just who rocks, who rots, and who rules. And that's basically it. The dumbest concept for a book. But so it was our first call on WFMU, so there's no reason for anyone listening to think that it wasn't real. This call went on forever. It was at least an hour or so. So people are calling in to, like, just let this author have it. Because, like, he's...
Wait, so when you started out, had you written, like, a premise of, like...
A premise, and then I remember I still have the list. It was just a list of who rots, who rocks, and who rules, and probably, like, 20 of each. And then that was how we started. And
some of them obviously provocative.
Yes. David Bowie rots because he's made too many changes over the years. Same with Neil Young. Like, just too many changes that don't... I can't follow it, so he rots. That sort of thing. And the Beatles had a lot of stinkers. So they rock. They don't rule. And so people were calling in to just take issue with this guy. And one guy called in to really argue over the fact that this author, Ronald Thomas Klontle, is the author. It's just like the most unwieldy last name of all time. Klontle.
Klontle.
Klontle. And he said, madness rules because they invented ska. And this guy kept calling back to just, you know, just and he had proof, too. Like, he had his records. Like, I'm holding in my hand the Birth of Ska album. And do you know what the first song is that's on it? And Ronald Klontle goes, is it Our House by Madness? And
so, just pushing his buttons further.
And so we, luckily we recorded it on a cassette tape that night. And we'd give this tape to bands. As the, you know, for like, when you're in a band, you're touring, like, you know, you just, you don't you're hear music bored. Anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So comedy was really big back then. And so we'd give a tape to Spoon. And Guided by Voices and Sleater-Kinney, and they would pass it around, and then it just kind of became this known thing. And then this tape, our friend Phil Morrison, who's a director, he got it in the hands of a guy at Comedy Central. Kent Alderman was the guy. And he thought it had potential to be something. Huh. And Tom and I ended up like kind of pitching this idea for like a fake, almost like a Fernwood Tonight talk show to MTV. And they went for it. So this is 98.
Wow.
And while this is happening, I'm playing in this band called Whiskey Town for the summer, which was Ryan Adams' band.
Yep.
And we're opening for John Fogerty. And so we're based here in New York. We're playing in Massachusetts or Connecticut or New Jersey. So we're coming home to the city every night. And Tom and I are working on those things during the day and going to these meetings during the day and then getting in the van and I go and play. So we're greenlit to do a pilot for it. And it gets 24 hours before the pilot's going to get shot. And they canceled it. So that was devastating. So then like a couple years go by and another friend of mine says, hey, I had this job at MTV where I was writing funny commercials for their in-house shows and I'm moving to another gig. Would you want to do it? And I thought, well, I've never done anything like this ever. But I tried it and I got in. So for the next at least like 4 or 5 years, when I was still playing in bands a little bit, I was making most of my money writing these freelance commercial gigs. Like, I'd write stuff in a van.
I think it's amazing that in that previous story and at this point where you are now, you have a foot in each world where you're
right.
playing in successful bands and you're respected enough as a drummer where, like, Ryan Adams will call
right.
you to sit in. But at the same time, you started to get this burgeoning like comedy.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
Very impressive.
And unexpected. Had no plans ever to be in comedy. But like was able to write for the, I think it was like the 2003 Movie Awards. So got to go to LA and be the writer on set with Justin Timberlake. And David Lee Roth was in one of them. And people like that. Just this whole world I never thought I'd be in. And then it was back to being in a van for a year. And then something else would come up. And then,
but you didn't run out of money, had to stop eating.
No, thankfully. Thankfully.
And then you did some work on Conan O'Brien.
Yes, there's a writer who wrote for Conan for a long time named Brian Stack, and he's a big indie rock fan. And he had this idea that I'd be good in this sketch. And he timed it for when Superchunk was playing a couple nights at, what was the tiny club? Brownies.
Studios place.
Yes. So yeah. We were playing there a couple nights and Brian Stack had this idea for this sketch where I would sit in for Max Weinberg. So they needed a guy that could play the drums and who uh-huh. could maybe read a cue card.
Yeah. Drum comedy.
Yes. Like, yeah. And so he thought I'd be good for this thing. And I said, all right, yeah, I'll try it. But it was terrifying because like I'm more of a stammerer than a stutterer since childhood. So like, am I going to be able to like do this? Am I going to freeze up? And so he had faith in me and we did it. And it was like, but it was a lot of lines too. Basically the joke was that they come back from commercial and I'm playing the drums with the band, but I have glasses and I'm dressed like him. And like, and Conan goes, you're not Max. And it turns out I'm a bodyguard. I'm a double for him. And cause he's been getting these death threats.
Oh, stunt double.
Yes. Yeah. And the payoff is that Max has been calling in his own death threats so he can get some kind of glory. But it was a lot of exchanges,
wow.
dialogue, but it went fine. And I was all prepared if I bombed to just drop out of society and just be a monk or something, but it worked. So, and then Brian had me back several times. And there was one sketch where I was the air guitarist with an ulterior motive. I'm playing air guitar, but it's a way for me to fondle myself. And so what they do with like the low extras is you'll sit out in the hall, and it was actually right out there in that hall, and you just kind of wait all day. And I was wearing this terrible metal Hesher outfit, like spike wristbands and
I stuff. Can't imagine you in that.
And
but
the door across the hallway is open, and it's just open, and it's just me and Brian Wilson just looking at each other. And he's in his dressing room, and he has no idea what to make of me. And I'm just embarrassed because it's the only chair left. Just sitting there, and we're just looking at each other, and who knows what he's thinking.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. That is a good story. So nowadays, you're still playing with Superchunk. Superchunk did take a break there for a while.
We did. We put out a record a week before 9/11 and went on tour. Obviously the world was in...
Yeah.
Flames and turmoil, and so terrible tour, and I just kind of had enough. I think Laura had enough too, and just wanted to try other things. Mm-hmm. Play with other people, and I played with Robert Pollard and a couple other bands and things, and that's when the writing stuff really kicked in. And then we just decided to try to get back together and make a record in 2010, I think it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that went well, and we've been churning them out still. Wow. Since then.
Your main gig now is Superchunk? You're kind of a
Every year is different. Every year, wow. Like, I play with Bob Mould, the great Bob Mould also.
Oh, right.
So I've been with
you
him.
You've made many records with
him.
Yeah,
so I've been with him for since 09, and I've been with the Mountain Goats since 07. No, but Bob is 08. So joined both of them very similar, around the same time.
How are you able to juggle three active bands' touring schedules?
No personal life at all. And I mean, I couldn't do it if I did. So like, there's nothing going on there. So it allows me a great amount of time to do all this. Yeah.
And sit in with us, the AG band.
Which is always fabulous.
Well, John, thanks so much. I'm sure there's plenty more stories, but we'll have next time you come back, we'll do some more.
That sounds great.
We'll do later era John Worster stories. Thanks so much for being with us. Hopefully we'll have you back again soon.
I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HG Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.